10:27 p.m. driving south on 89 from Stowe, Vermont. After we skied at Stowe today,
which was a blast.
And this is an interview for Laurel. It's her interview, actually, so she should do the talking. Hey, Laurel, set it up.
Okay, talking about.
Make sure you talk loud enough.
Yeah. Dad's history with music and his love for it. And he's going to tell some stories about it. So, here we go.
Okay. So we'll start when I was really young, okay? I'm talking like 2 or 3 years old. And I remember the music my mom and dad listened to. And I remember a record player they had, which was this big record player. It wasn't like a big console, you know, like people had in their living rooms. It was maybe like 2.5 feet wide by 2 feet tall and 1.5 deep. And it had speakers built into it. And it played, at the time they didn't really have albums, so it played 45s and 78s. And I can remember my parents having parties when I was little. And I think we lived in Key West, Florida. And my dad was in the Navy. And I remember the music they played. They played a lot of Elvis Presley. They played, so this is like this music, the stuff you hear when you're little, it sort of imprints on you, right? So the first things you hear when you're a kid, there's this whole theory about imprinting, not just music, but things that you see, things that you observe, that you hear, that you taste. So these are the things that I heard, right, and saw. So I saw people dancing, kind of rock and roll, like sort of like the pre the twist, you know, it wasn't yet the twist, but that kind of rock and roll. And my mom used to dance the jitterbug, too. She was a jitterbug dancer. I remember that stuff. And the music, I can remember, it was kind of a rock and roll thread, which included Elvis Presley. I remember Chuck Berry, them playing a lot of Chuck Berry. I remember like some Bill Haley and the Comets. Rock Around the Clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. I want to rock around the clock tonight. So there's that beat. It's like your basic, as I learned later, a 1-4-5 blues progression, right? So that's what that was, but I didn't know it when I was 3 years old. What else do I remember? There's another whole other thread of music that they listened to. I remember Hank Williams. I got a feeling called the blues since my baby said goodbye. You know that one?
Yeah.
So,
Grandma plays that a lot.
Yeah, you know? So all the Hank Williams tunes, I kind of grew up on Hank Williams. That was one thing. So this is early on stuff. So also when I was a little boy, we moved back to Ohio when I was maybe 3 or 4. And my dad's brother, Uncle Jerry, was a musician and he played electric guitar. I remember he had a gold Les Paul. That's what he had. So like when I was a little kid, I knew what a Les Paul was, you know? I knew what a Fender Twin Reverb amp was when I was 4 years old. Because like, that's the kind of stuff that I was immersed in, you know? Also at the same time, this is when the Beatles first really hit it big in the U.S. And my Uncle Jerry was in an early rock and roll band, sort of emulating the Beatles and other bands, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things I remember was the first Beatles movie. What was that movie?
Hard Day's Night.
Hard Day's Night, yeah. I remember with my Grandma Harple in Sandusky, Ohio, waiting in line at the theater to get tickets for a Hard Day's Night. And you not only got a ticket, you got like this souvenir thing that was maybe 10 inches long, 4 inches high, had pictures of the Beatles on it and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember going to that, and while watching the movie, you know, you see all that old footage of the Beatles?
Yeah.
With people screaming and stuff? People did that during the movie.
Oh my God.
And
horrible.
I think years old at this point, I'd say. Because what was that one around 1965?
Yeah.
Might have been 64.
You're 54.
64, yeah. So I was 4 or 5 years old then. So that's an early memory I had. Part of that memory was the albums around Grandma Harple's house, because Uncle Jerry lived with Grandma Harple then. But he was just a teenager. And I remember those early Beatles albums being there. That's the main thing. They're major, major Beatle fans. So this is all this early imprinting stuff, you know, that you remember. Now, the first musical instrument I got was a little drum set. And this was, I think I might have been 4 or 5 years old. They gave me the drum set at Grandma's house for Christmas in Sandusky, Ohio. And the drum set was called the Liverpool Compact. And it was this sort of, in those days they didn't have Toys R Us, but if they did, this would have been the kind of drum set you bought at Toys R Us.
Yeah. Okay?
And it's had the Liverpool Compact. And with it, I remember I got a pair of bell-bottom pants. They weren't jeans, they were pants. With a thick white belt. And I remember a maroon shirt with gold polka dots on it. And that was sort of, it was more probably influenced like by the Monkees,
yeah,
the Beatles, right? But, you know, everything was sort of converging then. So that was like my first instrument, basically. And I started taking drum lessons and stuff when I was a little kid. I mean, I was really young to take lessons on that. I didn't really take lessons yet. So I was still only like 4 years old. I think for my birthday when I was 5, for my birthday present was a little record player. And this was a little record player. It was 14 inches wide, 14 inches deep, and 8 inches high. And it was brown, had little speakers in the front that you couldn't see, and a cover that, it was on a hinged cover that came over. And it played, 33 and a third, 45 RPM, and 78 RPM. And that's when, actually, that's when I started my record collection when I was 5 years old.
Wow.
My first album was that Mom got for me, or it might have been Grandma, I don't know who got it for me, was Meet the Beatles. It was the one where on the back they're standing, and I think John's facing backwards with his arm on the other guy's shoulder.
Yeah.
You know that one? I think, I'm pretty sure it was Meet the Beatles. And I wore that thing out. So, as I was growing up, now remember, this is like I'm 5 years old. The Beatles broke up when I was in 7th grade, okay? I remember distinctly, which I think was approximately 1971 or so. That's when they broke up. So, for me, the Beatles, I grew up with that as like the major musical influence. So, instrument-wise, this kind of coincides with the business my dad was in, because we moved around a lot when I was kind of moving into second, third grade. That year, I think we lived in 3 different places. We lived in Ohio. My dad worked for NASA as an engineer there. And then we moved to Michigan. My dad worked for General Motors at the General Motors Proving Ground.
GM.
Yeah. Yep. And then, apparently he just didn't like these jobs. I mean, I was a little kid, so I don't remember all the details. But I was taking drum lessons the whole time. I remember then after that, Dad moved to Rhode Island to work for Raytheon Company. And I remember living, so my main musical lessons and things didn't happen until we moved back to Ohio. Because what happened, we started in Ohio, right at NASA. We went to Michigan for GM. Then Dad moved us to Rhode Island. We lived in Rhode Island for, I'd say, 6 months. Might have been less. And during this phase, actually, we went to Hawaii. And I remember getting exposed to Hawaiian music when that was there. Sort of the, you know, there was the modern sort of top 40 stuff like Don Ho, Tiny Bubbles, that kind of stuff.
Ukulele?
Yeah, ukulele music. Just basically, you know, Hawaiian music. But what happened was, I think we didn't like living in Rhode Island for, I think Mom hated it. I think we, you know, we were from Ohio, really, so people in New England seemed to be very harsh and unfriendly. And I think Mom hated it. So she basically, here's an interesting story. We moved back to the same house we lived in. I don't know how this happened. But when we moved away, we lived in a house right on a beach on Lake Erie. It's here in Ohio. And we literally went away for, you know, a year or so, maybe 2 years, and moved back to the same house. Okay? So that house kind of is sort of symbolic for stuff for me. So anyway, we moved back there. Dad, I think this is sort of Dad's entrepreneurial phase. He was trying different businesses. I think he learned from working for these big companies that he'd rather work for himself. So he tried several forays at working for himself. And one of those, which lasted a fairly long time, was he was partners in this music store called Hayes Music Company, which was in Sandusky, Ohio.
H-E-Y-S.
I think it was H-E-Y-S, yeah. I don't think it was H-A-Y-E-S, it was H-E-Y-S. So I have... Hayes, yeah. So I have... And I remember the owners of Hayes Music, it's an old guy named Floyd Hayes, and his son Harvey. And Harvey was, at the time, and Dad would cringe at this, but he was kind of a hero for me. Because when I was that age, I was actually pretty precocious. You know, I could carry on conversations with adults and stuff. And kind of like the way Katie is.
Yeah.
You know? Maybe even more so, though, than Katie. And Harvey treated me not like a kid. He treated me like a guy. Like a friend, right? So, during that time, I spent a lot of time with my dad. And I would go to the music store with him, like, every day. And I would hang out in the music store. I learned how a business works, right? You know, you have to order stuff. It arrives, like, at the loading dock. You have to take it out. You have to display it, you know, like, so the music would arrive, sheet music, and I'd help take that out and put it in the racks and display it. I remember when we used to sell Hammond and Lowry organs, and, you know, we didn't have a lot of guitars and stuff. It was more keyboard instruments and amplifiers and stuff like that, Leslie cabinets and things like that. So I learned about all this stuff that, you know, I learned how everything works when I was about 6 years old, I guess, you know, all these instruments. And I started taking lessons. Harvey actually started teaching me how to play the organ, the electronic organ, so I learned that. And ultimately, I wound up taking lessons on that for probably 8 years, maybe, 8 or 9 years. So I actually got pretty darn good. I did. You know, I played the organ very heavily up until, and remember, my dad owned a music store, right? So I mean, we ultimately moved away from Ohio, but I had a big Hammond. It wasn't a B3, it was a C3, which is the same thing as a B3, but with a more of a furniture-like cabinet, basically like the kind of organ you might see in a church.
Yeah.
And I had a large Leslie cabinet, and these are the kind of big. This is like when you listen to like the Allman Brothers Band from the 70s, Greg Allman played a Hammond B3 organ, okay? So when you listen to Traffic, Steve Winwood played a Hammond B3 organ. So I had been playing a Hammond B3 since I was like 7 years old or something, right? So I learned how to read music sort of effortlessly. I mean, I could spot read music by the time I was about, I'd say 9 or 10. So you could that's because of Harvey and Floyd Haynes. So I don't know if these lessons cost anything, because, you know, we didn't have a lot of money when I was growing up. And for some way, Dad always, I never felt like I wanted for any single thing, ever. You know, even though we didn't have any money. You know, relatively. It's not like we were poor or anything, but we certainly weren't, like, living on the rich side of town, you know?
Yeah.
So I spent lots of time with Dad. So one of the things, a memory on this music store thing, is there would be county fairs in Ohio, like Erie County Fair. There would be Cuyahoga County Fair. And these were like big deals in Ohio back in the early 70s. Like, remember, this is the late 60s, early 70s, okay? Probably more so late 60s, actually. So I think what happened was they realized that, whoa, you know, this little kid can actually play the organ. I can play anything. And a lot of the popular music then, I mean, think some things they used to play on the organ. I remember when Jesus Christ Superstar came out?
Yeah.
I played every song in Jesus Christ Superstar by memory, okay? Like, no problem. There was a play that came out then called Godspell. I played all those tunes. I played all the Beatles stuff. At the time, you could still get these in music stores. They're called fake books. What they are is, it's songs, and like the chord structures for the songs, and it's written by hand. So someone's listened to that, and they've listened to the song, and they've sort of transposed it, and they call that a fake book. And at the time, anyway, every professional musician had a fake book, and they're these really thick books, you know, like 2 inches. And so what happened is, if you're a professional musician, you're playing out, people are going to request, the audience is going to request songs, right?
Yeah.
This is at the, you had, this was like really before rock and roll took off, right? You had to know how to read so you could play anything. So someone would yell out, "Raindrops keep falling on my head." That was the real popular tune back then, Burt Bacharach, right? "Raindrops keep falling on my head." You know, kind of a bad song, right? But anyway, it was really popular. So all these songs would be in fake books. So basically, I devoured all these fake books. So at the time, I might have, I'm not exaggerating, I would say that I knew hundreds of songs from memory, just from fake books, okay?
Yeah.
Because, like, remember, when you're a little kid, just like you guys were, in the way Katie is and stuff, your brains are sponges, right?
Yeah.
You're, like, absorbing everything. And I was just doing that naturally, right? So, getting back to the story, I'm rambling a bit. What Dad did with Harvey is they had this big trailer, and into this trailer they would load organs and pianos, basically, lots of them. And we'd go to the fair, and we'd put like a tent in front of the trailer, and the trailer opened up, right? We had this basically a portable music store on display, Hayes Music, right? And I used to love going to the fair, because when I wasn't, I actually worked the fair, so it was sort of kid labor. You know, they never paid me anything. I never actually even thought that I would need to get paid. It never even occurred to me. It was just what I did. Yeah, it was fun. So going to the fair meant that I got to go to all the fairs. When I wasn't playing, I'd walk around the fair, go on the rides. And these are, remember, the late 60s, early 70s, these were the fair days when they actually had like freak shows and stuff. They'd have people, they'd have the guy who lays on the 1,000 nail bed. They'd have like the tattooed guy, they'd have the midget.
Fat kid in the truck.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. They'd have like the midget Siamese twins.
Yeah.
I mean, all kinds of bizarre stuff, you know. The tattooed lady, you know, horrible stuff, right? So you'd walk in and I'm a little kid, right? And I'm like, oh God, oh my God. Like, so then when I wasn't, so, you know, Dad or Harvey would give me like a quarter or something, or 50 cents, and say, you know, go walk around, get some popcorn or stuff like that. So I'd go hang around. So I was sort of like a carnival fair kid for a while. stuff, I'd sit there playing. And then Dad and Harvey would be like the sales guys. So people would walk by and they'd be like, wow, that little kid's really playing music. And actually, I played very good, actually. So I think, I mean, it sounded really good. You know, it wasn't like a little kid playing badly. And then, so Dad and Harvey's pitch would be, yeah, well, you know, a little kid can do it. You can do it. A little kid can do it. And they'd be like, really? Yeah, really, you know. And, you know, when you buy this organ, we'll give you, like, 5 for 10 free lessons or something like that. So it's, like, part of the sales pitch.
Yeah.
So often what would happen is they'd be kind of closing a customer, right? And they would try to, they'd also offer, I learned a lot of stuff about business. They'd offer discounts at the fair, right? You know, at the county fair. If you buy it now, the discount's X, you know? So it was really kind of a historical, or I guess going to school on capitalism, because it was like learning how to be a little capitalist, you know? And I learned how to, as I think about this later on when I did my first company, I was known for being very, very particular about doing demos, and I would orchestrate the demos precisely. And we would train our guys to do them precisely like I did the demos. So I would give the demo, and my partner Rich was great at this, and he was very meticulous too. I would say, here's our software. This is exactly how you demo it. I do not want you to waver from this. You have to do it like this. And what happened was all of our systems engineers kind of learned how to demo from me. And that's how we scaled the company, because I taught them how to demo because I was a really good demo guy. And ultimately, the biggest demo I ever did was for Jim Clark from Netscape, and I did the demo. Myself and Rich, we did the demo. We didn't let our systems engineers do it, we did the demo. But on all those demo skills, Dad probably never thought of this, but that stuff came from me being like a 7-year-old boy or 8-year-old boy sitting playing a Lowry or a Hammond organ at Ohio State Fairs. That's when I learned how to demo. Because really, what was I doing? I was demoing the organ, you know? Because there were certain songs that we used, like certain pre-settings on the organ. And Harvey would say, oh, play this song and use the Leslie speaker, you know? So I knew how to, like, demo the features in the organ. So that gets us up to what? Maybe up to 10 years old. So I learned how to play the drums. By the way, I didn't mention, I got a real drum set, which was, there's several major brands of drums. Ludwig is a brand. There's another brand called Slingerland. I got a Slingerland drum set, which is basically like a real rock and roll drum set. And I got that maybe when I was 8 or 9 or something like that. But you know, when you're a little kid, you're interested in lots of stuff. I was just like other kids, I was interested in machines and stuff like that. So one of the things I liked about, I had G.I. Joes. And the G.I. Joe then was the big G.I. Joe. It was like this tall. It came on a foot locker that was a wooden foot locker.
Yeah.
That's the G.I. Joe that I had. One of the things I liked about Harvey was his family owned a campground, which was basically a, I don't know how much land they had, but it was a fair amount of land. And they had a Ford tractor, an old Ford tractor, which might have been like a 1940s tractor. This thing was hard to drive. This is one of the things I loved about Harvey. He treated me like I was another buddy, even though I was a little kid. And I think Mom and Dad might have had issues with Harvey, because he let me do stuff that they would never let me do. He taught me how to drive this big farm tractor when I was about 8 years old. And I would love going out to their place, because he would just say, yeah, you can drive the tractor around. And I would just go drive this big tractor, full-size tractor, when I was like 8 or 9 years old, driving it around. Which is kind of cool, right?
Yeah.
So Harvey was a really cool guy. I mean, Dad wouldn't think so, because ultimately I think Dad and Harvey had a falling out on their business. Another thing, I remember every year there was like the national trade show for the music industry. And one year it was in Miami Beach. So that year, I'm not sure how old I was then. I bet you I was maybe 10 years old. Let's make sure I do 93. This is 91. Okay. What we did is Dad had a pickup truck with a camper on the back of it. And so you can sleep in the back and stuff, you know? You've seen these, right?
Like thingies now, or?
Nah, it was much smaller than that. It was a pickup truck, and the camper fit in the pickup truck.
Oh,
so you could
yeah.
ride back there while you were driving. So Dad and Harvey, of course, were going to go to the National Music Show, the music convention, down in Miami Beach. So, of course, I went everywhere with Dad back in those days, right? By the way, I went everywhere with Dad until I was about 15 years old. I spent every weekend with my dad. And I played sports on weekend, and Dad, when I was little, Dad coached my little league team in Timberton. Dad used to go to all my football games when we played football in high school. But one of my first jobs was because Dad, you know, Dad's a big skeet shooter, right?
Yeah.
And my first job, really, besides my first paying job, was working at the Erie County Conservation League. I was a trap boy. So I used to set, basically, I would maintain the skeet and trap fields, and they paid me $1 an hour. So on a weekend, it'd be really cool, because I could make like 15 or 16 bucks on a weekend.
That's pretty good.
For a little kid, that was a lot of dough back then, you know?
Yeah.
And I saved all my money, because I desperately wanted a mini bike back then. And ultimately, Dad got me a little Kawasaki mini bike. But anyway, back to the music convention deal. So Dad and Harvey take the truck with the camper on it. We're going to drive to Miami Beach. And what I remember was somewhere along the way, we drove from Ohio all the way down to Florida. I got an earache, which I guess it turns out was an ear infection. I almost lost my hearing, actually. And Mom, to this day, is mad at Dad because he didn't know what to do. They took me to the hospital. I guess I was on the... I was really close from actually becoming deaf. It was that bad. And I remember the time, how incredibly painful it was. But Dad was... Like, in those days, remember, Dad was even less confident than I am. You know, like mothering or nurturing kids.
Yeah.
So he was basically clueless. And remember, there were no cell phones, right? It wasn't like you just called up Mom and said, what do you do? But anyway, we went to this music trade show. I was sick as a dog. I had fever and all this stuff. But I was excited because I got to meet Buddy Rich, who was... really famous jazz drummer, Buddy Rich. So I got to meet him. You can stop it for a second if you want.
Started.
Okay. Okay, so let's talk about school bands. Okay. Because I was always in the school band too. School band started, I think, in fourth grade. Played drums in the school band, but what? Remember, by this time I'd been playing drums. I had a drum set and everything. The problem I had in school bands was I was way too advanced for the school band because my dad owned a music store and I've been playing instruments and stuff, and I could read music very, very well by that age, right? I mean, I could read the way the music is. There's like the bass clef, you know, the left, the lower stuff. Which is harder to read than the, you know, the stuff you're doing to, like, your right hand.
The treble clef,
yeah. So, I could read, I could spot read, and also by then I had developed kind of a, like, what's the word for it, when you can hear something and play it? I had, huh? I had an ear, you know, I had a good ear.
Yeah.
Like, if you sang to me, I could tell you what key it was in. I could listen to a song and say, that's in B flat or whatever. You know, I knew what key it was in. So remember, so this is a public school in here in Ohio. So I joined the band, I played drums, and it was like wicked boring. Because no one knew how to do anything. You know how bad like little kid bands sound?
Yeah.
It sucked really bad. So, and I'm,
too good for that.
I mean, I'm already playing the drums, a full drum set, and I'm in this band where like I gotta play a snare drum where it's completely rudimentary, you know? So I hated it. But I was in it because everybody was in the band. It was, you know, it was a social thing to do. If you weren't in the band, there was like something wrong with you, you know? So I was in the band. So then I talked to Dad, and he was like, well, why don't you just pick up a different instrument then, you know? And one of the things the music store did was we provided musical instruments to all the local schools. We sold it to the schools. So like trumpets, cornets, trombones,
flutes,
clarinets, tubas. Dad sold all this stuff, right? And it turns out that Floyd Hayes, Mr. Hayes, and Harvey played the sax. So they said, well, I've got a sax, why don't you take my saxophone? So I took the sax and I started to learn how to play the sax. And it turned out that I could actually, I picked it up really fast. Mainly because I could read, you know, already. So it's like, you know how some people have like another language? The other language for me when I was a kid was music. Because I could, you know, like when they say when little kids can learn another language very fast.
Yeah.
That's, well, the other language for me was music. I learned how to read and play different instruments when I was a little kid. So I picked up the sax and I played alto and then I played tenor. And I wanted to play tenor because it was bigger and it had like a deeper sound. And at the time I thought, well, if I play a deeper instrument, it'll be a lot cooler. So anyway, here's a story I still remember. I still remember the guy's name. His name was George Lehrer, L-E-H-R-E-R. He was the like the band. Yeah, I don't know what to call the guy. The band teacher. He was the head of the band for all the grades all the way through high school. And this school had a very major band program. And it would culminate every year in a big concert in the high school gym where all the grades would get together on the floor. And the big thing was they'd play the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Okay? It was like a major deal. But I remember we were playing, getting ready for a concert we were doing. And it was just cacophony. It sounded like shit, right? None of the kids could play anything. I remember we're playing, and I was playing it perfectly. And so the Mr. Lehrer's there conducting, and there was a whole melody line that the saxophone section had, which was maybe four other kids and myself. And they're all honking and squeaking and everything. It sounded terrible. Mr. Lehrer, I remember, you know the sound of a conducting, what's that thing called?
Stick thing?
The wand, yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine that hitting onto a music stand. Click, 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 click. I remember suddenly he stops. Click, 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 click. He says, what is that over there? He stopped the whole band. He said, is that you, Danny Harpool? And I remember I was scared. I'm like, oh, shit. Did I do something wrong? And he stopped the whole band. And he looked at me and said, you're actually playing that, aren't you? I thought to myself, well, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. Why did you humiliate me in front of the whole band? And then he said to the whole band, you guys listen to Danny Harpool because he's playing what you're supposed to play. And I remember my ego sort of like swelled. I was like, yeah. And so I think I was in maybe fifth grade or sixth grade when that happened. So that's sort of like a little band anecdote.
Nice one. I like that one.
Because I was actually playing it, you know, playing what you're supposed to play. Where do we go from here? We should go to...
What happened with guitar? When did guitar
Okay, the guitar came in later, okay? And the reason it came in was we had moved back to Rhode Island now. And by now I'm like really good on the organ. But the organ's not cool.
Yeah.
You know, it's not cool.
You like old ladies.
Yeah, you know, I could play really rockin' though. Like, I could have played, if I could have found a band, and I could have been like Greg Allman or somebody like that, you know, or Stevie Winwood or somebody, but, you know, also for bands typically, they never had any money, and the kind of organ I had at the time cost about, you know, $8,000, which was like, during that time, Dad only made like $12,000 a year, right? So that was a shitload of money. So, like, for a kid to have a big Hammond B3 organ with a Leslie cabinet, totally unheard of. Plus, I couldn't even drive yet, you know? I mean, I was still a kid. So, I was sort of an oddball kid because of my sort of savant ability on the organ. And it's at a certain point in every kid's career, you care more about fitting in than standing out, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened to me. So I thought, you know, the rockin' instrument is really a guitar. So I should switch to guitar. So I don't know what possessed Dad to do this, but I think I might have been in 9th grade, maybe. Maybe going into 10th grade. It was a Christmas present. Dad got me a nylon string classical guitar. I mean, I knew a fair amount about guitars because when I was little, you know, I knew that what a Les Paul was, I knew what an SG was, I knew what a Stratocaster and a Telecaster were, I knew all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
And the thing was, I was ecstatic that I got this guitar. And Dad's perspective was, well, you already read far better than most people, so I don't want you to just sort of, Dad always sort of looked down on the rock musicians because most of them couldn't read music, and it's sort of kind of a snob way to look at it. But the reality was, you know, even Jimi Hendrix couldn't read music, you know.
Yeah.
But that's where
he can play well.
Yeah, you know, that was the big thing.
Yeah.
So what Dad did was he got me this guitar, and I wound up taking lessons from this guy named. Turns out he was a student of a famous guitarist named, I can't remember the guy's name. Shit, I got a mental block on this. It'll come to me though. Famous classical guitarist, Spanish guy. This guy's name was Joe Raposo. And it turned out that his son was the guy who composed all the music for Sesame Street. And Mr. Raposo had a studio. Well, he was a student of a guy named Andre Segovia. Segovia is a famous guitarist, right? Famous classical guitarist. So I wind up learning how to play classical guitar. Which, do you know how classical guitar sounds?
Yeah, it's kind of like do-do-do-do-do. Not really, like.
It's sort of like, you can play like Bach, you know?
Yeah.
And stuff like that on classical guitar. So I get heavily into the classical guitar. So here's what happened is my attempt to be cool is completely scuttled, right? Because I learned to play the most arcane sort of form of music on the guitar. Highly sort of intellectual, cerebral guitar. And that formed my style. So my style on the guitar, classical guitar, is you use all four of your left fingers. You hardly ever do like a bar chord. You don't learn any rock and roll structures. It's completely different, right?
Yeah.
So, I took lessons, I'd say, for about four to six years. I don't remember exactly. It's a big difference, but I don't remember. Every day, or every week, Mom would drive me down to Mr. Raposo's studio. He's this old guy. It's very formal. We'd go into his studio. He'd always be very dressed up. And we'd sit there and you play the classical guitar with a guitar on leg up on a little stool, and he placed the guitar on that at an angle. And I remember at the time he would marvel to Mom that I was learning so fast. This is just a byproduct because it was another language I had learned when I was a kid, because I could read really well already. Well, the big challenge when you learn an instrument is to learn how to read. I already knew how to read. So I was progressing like rapidly on the classical guitar, and I actually enjoyed it. You know, I totally enjoyed it. But this is at an age where, you know, we'd get together and we're starting to listen to music like Neil Young, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, stuff like that. I'd get together with my friend Tim, for example, who couldn't read music, but he learned chords. And he sounded really cooler than I did, but he didn't know anything, right?
Yeah.
He didn't know what he was doing. And I was sort of like a music snob, and I would look down on certain musicians because I knew that they didn't know anything, so it sort of really colored my view. And then my lead style was just, you know, you play rhythm and lead. But like when you play classical guitar, you play both of them at the same time. So what happened was, that's the way I learned how to play guitar. So it really set my, you know, like this imprinting idea, right? That's imprinted on me on how you play guitar. So that explains to me why, like, I like Frank Zappa right now, okay? You know, my whole life. Because Frank Zappa is a very, he's a trained musician. He's an orchestra musician, right? So, like, his style influenced me. And what happened was I ultimately said to Dad, "Dad, I got to get an electric guitar, you know? I mean, this is not happening. I mean, I can't play this anywhere. No one will." It's like if you walked into a party and somebody sat down and started playing Beethoven. You'd be like, "Oh, that kid's really good, but, you know, what's with that anyway, right?" So I was really driven by peer pressure to, I wanted to play something that people would want to hear. So the first guitar I actually had, Dad didn't give me. My girlfriend at the time gave it to me. And it was called a Dan Electro. And it was green, sort of shaped like a, kind of like a Telecaster.
Yeah.
And at the time, I didn't know much about it. But it turns out now, if I had that Dan Electro right now, that guitar would probably be worth about $10,000 to $20,000 now. At the time, though, her father's brother had it and didn't use it anymore, so she gave it to me. And I found it very hard to play. I mean, also a classical guitar, the neck on a classical guitar is very wide.
Yeah.
And that's what I was used to playing. And the neck on this Dan Electro was maybe 30% narrower. And I just found it goofy, you know? It's like, I can't even play this thing, you know? And what I should have done is found somebody to give me some rock and roll lessons, but I never did that. So what I did is, by now, right, since I started collecting albums when I was 5, I had a massive album collection. Probably, like, the collection you see now at the house, my collection was almost that big then, okay? So I'm, like, going to, like, 10th grade, and what I'm doing is I'm playing along with music because I can pick it up by ear. So the way I learned rock guitar was listening to, like at the time, like Eric Clapton. My big influences then were Eric Clapton, Todd Rundgren, Frank Zappa, and maybe Neil Young. Those are like my big influences. So I'm trying to sound like them on a classical nylon string guitar. In my bedroom, right? While my mom's yelling, turn it down in there. So I learned all these tunes. So what happened was, I went to college, and before I went to college, Dad got me, by now I'd broken up with my girlfriend, right? She took the Dan Electro back.
Oh,
so I had no electric guitar to go. So Dad got me a guitar called a Kramer. Kramer's went on to be really famous. I actually had a Kramer prototype guitar that Dad had finagled somehow. I don't know how he got the thing. And an Ampeg amp. So, you know, the amp was okay, but what I really wanted was a Fender Twin, you know? So, like, I kind of sort of had this oddball setup. I had a Kramer, which had, like, a pitchfork neck, you know? So, at the time, it looked really radical. story in college when we tie-dyed all of our equipment and stuff. But we so anyway, I get this Kramer and this Ampeg amp, so I'm like an oddball guy out of the gate. Everybody had like a Stratocaster and a Fender Twin Reverb. I've got this weird setup. Further, when I play, at the time there was a famous guitarist named John McLaughlin, and they called him Mahavishnu John McLaughlin. And he played, he was a, sort of in the early 70s to mid 70s, a new style came out called Fusion. Fusion was where musicians took class, you know, jazz music and fused it with rock and roll. It was very electronic. And John McLaughlin played with people like Miles Davis. He was a very famous guitarist, but he was also classically trained. So I remember when I got to college, I would start playing with people and I'd go and they'd say, let's jam, right? So we'd start jamming and I sounded like John McLaughlin because of my classical background. And my nickname through college was Mahavishnu Dan Harpo. So people would call me Mahavishnu, which, you know, Mahavishnu is an Indian word, right?
Yeah. Because Vishnu's the god.
Yeah, yeah. So I was sort of, I got this reputation of sort of like guitar guru type guy.
Yeah.
Because my style still wasn't rock and roll. You know, like even today, my style's really not rock and roll. At the time, I'd say around 72 or 73, I became really, that's when I sort of fell in love with Jerry. Started listening to all Grateful Dead. So I always aspired to sound like Jerry. He was like my main influence, really. You know, for example, I was really into Led Zeppelin, but I could never, ever play like that because of my I was so classically oriented, I couldn't play that kind of stuff. So that kind of leads into college, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so then what happened was I saved up some money, and my two guitar, my three guitar heroes, basically, Todd R., Frank Zappa, Jerry Garcia, okay? Those are my three hero guys. So I saved up and I got a Gibson SG. You know, like my painted guitar now? Same guitar as that. It was a 72 SG. The same guitar Frank Zappa and Todd played. So I got that guitar. And that's what I actually wound up playing through all my bands with in college. So our bands, we played stuff like, we played some original stuff, but mostly covers. Lots of Allman Brothers, lots of Grateful Dead, Carlos Santana, The Who, we played The Doors, tons of stuff. We never played any Yes. Yes was, you had to have a really good band to play Yes. Steve Howe is like a guitarist that I could, when I talk about the guys who are, I can see as the major guys I just mentioned, Steve Howe and Yes, is even, I think, like in a different echelon altogether, right? His style is so, he's a classically trained guitarist, but he took his style and made it rock and roll. And if you ask any of those guitarists to play like Steve Howe, they'd be like, there's no way. So, like, I can listen to something now, I can listen to music and I can usually tell you like who the guitarist is. It's by their style or their tone, that kind of stuff. So I started developing my own tone probably around third year of college. Because what I did was I had so much fun in college that basically, this was the 70s, right? What I did was I stayed in college for like 10 years. And I skied and I played rock and roll and partied pretty much. So that was like my lifestyle. And I learned all kinds of tunes. I played with some really amazing guys back then who I learned a lot from. But one of the things we did was, this is when I moved back to Rhode Island because I couldn't afford to go to school in Vermont anymore. we all lived together in a house in Matunuck, and we're heavily influenced by the Grateful Dead. And at the time, the Dead had just come off of a tour where all their equipment was tie-dyed. So I went through a phase where everything was tie-dyed. So I came home from college, like after my second or third year, all my clothes were tie-dyed, my jeans, my t-shirts, my socks, my underwear. Everything was tie-dyed. I was totally into it. My hair was about this long. Say way past my shoulders, right? And I had more of it then too. I wasn't like as balding as I am now. And I had tie-dyed my amplifier. So my amp was tie-dyed just like Jerry's. And further, what I had done that year when I came home from college was I had these large king-size sheets, which I had tie-dyed like all psychedelic colors. And in my bedroom, I made the whole bedroom psychedelic. So I put tie-dyed sheets on the floor for rugs. Over the rugs, tie-dyed bedspread. I hung them on the walls. And on the ceiling, I hung them, and we had perfected this technique where you use like a baby pin, and it would look like puffy clouds on your ceiling. So you walked into my room and it was like, oh my God. And I remember by then I was so disruptive because I'd play my electric guitar and listen to music all the time. Because what happened, I went to college, I came back and I totally changed, you know. And they moved me into the basement at my parents' house because I wasn't allowed to live upstairs anymore. And so the room's all set up. I'm just in nirvana. My dad comes home and just went crazy. Told me I had to have a job by that Friday. Because I didn't even have a job. I mean, my job basically was hanging out, playing guitar and stuff, you know, with other people. So I basically said, if you don't have a job by Friday, you know, you got to move out of the house. So I scrambled and I got a job. I painted that summer. I painted a house. I worked for the school system. I painted classrooms. But that kind of set I'd say there was probably like a 2-year phase, maybe 3 years, where we had a band that was very, very much like the Dead, kind of like a jazz, combination of a jazz Dead band. Built all our equipment. I really got into this. We built our whole PA system. So I designed all the stuff. With Dad helped me do all the electronics. We built all the large speaker cabinets and stuff. I built them myself. Very heavy duty stuff. And everything was tie-dyed. So we would set up and we were just like the coolest looking band, you know. We would have those sheets, tie-dyed sheets hanging all over the place. All the instruments were tied, all the amps and everything were tie-dyed in our PA. And we started to play a lot of jobs, like around Rhode Island. We were getting paying jobs. So like the first paying gig that was like the most impactful gig for me was there used to be a club in Newport called Harpo's Jazz Club. H-A-R-P-O, Harpo's. And lots of famous people played at Harpo's, like Bose Allison played there, famous jazz pianist. Dizzy Gillespie had played there. So, you know, shit, we got a job at Harpo's, right? And I think we charged like $1 or $2 at the door. And that night we made maybe like $350. And back then that was a lot of money, right? And I just remember thinking, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. This is it. This is totally it. Because by then, too, the band was starting to sort of gel. You know, it takes a long time to get a good band because lots of times bands are bad because some of the people are bad, you know. And there was a time when I was like one of the bad people in the band because you're trying to do rock and roll, but I'm like Mahavishnu Dan. So, like, you know, so we played like Rolling Stones, and Rolling Stones as played by Mahavishnu Dan, you know, like Brown Sugar. Can't get no satisfaction. All that stuff played with me on rhythm guitar was just totally wrong. job I remember. I remember playing some parties in college at URI. When I went to URI, every Friday, it was a tradition. It happened for years. They called it, I'm going to tell you this, but don't be shocked. It was called High Noon. And this was in the 70s, so every Friday at noon, everyone would go on the quad at URI and smoke marijuana. That's what it was. That's why they called it High Noon. So there'd be like hundreds, a thousand kids out there having a big pot party, right? So so we're like the psychedelic band, so multiple High Noons, we would run extension cords out of the big academic buildings. And we had a little stage set up. We would set up and we would play the quad at High Noon, which was some of the best parties ever. People dancing, like hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, major party. Some of the beach bars in South County, there's a place in Matuna called the Ocean Mist. There's a club called the Bon View. These are like beach bars. We would set up and play in these bars and play until the place shut down and even longer. You know, like people dancing, just people having an awesome time. Probably the wildest party I ever played. I bet you there was close to 1,000 people at this party. We were like the lead band at this party. So other bands would play, and then we'd have like our big setup there because we had the big PA and everything.
Yeah.
And we were really big at like improvisation and jamming, like the Grateful Dead. So we would be like playing one tune, we'd be jamming on it for like 20 minutes, then we kind of work our way into another song. So we started to develop a style like the Dead. And we did some of the Dead jams too, just like they did them. People were just really into that. This party, I remember playing it when you turn into the main entrance at URI. It's a very old building called the Kingston Inn, which is probably like about 300 years old. But a lot of students live there. And we were set up outside on a stage, completely mobbed with people. And I remember we were playing, and I looked up, and there was a guy. I even remember his name now, Jimmy Kilcoyne. This wild guy. He was up on the third story of the building and fell off the building because he was so high or something, right? He was so drunk or whatever. And he fell and he landed on the ground. And it was shocking. It's like, oh my God, this guy killed himself. The band's playing. We're playing some Allman Brothers tune or something like that, you know? And I stopped playing. For a second, the rest of the band stopped playing, and then what happened was it started to turn into like a freak out riot, you know. And then what happened was he got up, and ultimately he was okay, and they brought him into the house, and ultimately somebody took him to the hospital. But we started playing again. I learned then. I mean, I didn't realize until afterwards, but it's like the way a mob works. The way a huge crowd works. And it sort of reminds me of movies like that classic movie of the Stones at Altamont. You ever see that movie?
No.
Where there was at Altamont Speedway in California. This is after Woodstock. The Rolling Stones played this big show, right? And it was huge. It was a huge show. And the security they used, the Hell's Angels. And the Hell's Angels started to beat people up in front of the stage because there was stage security. And when the Rolling Stones stopped playing, there was a riot. It started going crazy. So they kept playing. And this is, you know, it's the exact same thing, but on a much, much tinier scale. You know, this is a tiny little scale. I mean, let's face it, we're like a college band playing a big party at a college. You know, it's totally different. But it was the same thing. Because when we stopped playing, it was like pandemonium, or like a riot started to ensue. We started playing again just to kind of, so everybody would start dancing and not notice that something terrible had just happened. And I remember playing and thinking, just wanting to stop and go see if this guy was okay. By then I kind of, see what happens is in your life, this goes back to when I was a little kid, Dad would always say, you don't want to grow up and be like Uncle Jerry. And, you know, my Uncle Jerry was a guitarist. And I'd be like, well, why don't I want to be like Uncle Jerry? He'd say, because Uncle Jerry's a bum. He's just a musician. So, it's sort of like, there's a theme I have about life that everything's got paradox in it. And the paradox of my musical life is my dad's the one who turned me on to all this musical stuff, right? At the same time, my dad's the one who said, don't make this your profession. Right? And I think if I actually had not listened to my dad, I would have been a musician for my whole life.
Wow.
And I think I would have actually been...
pretty big?
I think I would have been famous in some way. I don't know what. There was a point where... this is so funny about how I met Todd later in life. Because at a certain point when I was probably about 15... I want you to think about this. When you're your age, things that you think about totally matter. Don't let anybody ever say that what you think doesn't matter. Because the things you think about, the things you want to be now, that's just as valid as what you want to be when you're 30. Okay?
Yeah.
Because so when I was like about 15, I was so into Todd. Like I got, the first album I got from Todd was an album called The Ballad of Todd Rundgren. And then after that, he had an album out called Something Anything. And it's the Change My Life album, right? This album, it's a double album. He played every instrument on the album. Every single instrument, guitar, keyboards, drums, bass, the whole thing. Sort of like boy genius, you know? And I thought, man, he played saxophone. I thought, wow, you know, if I keep doing this, I could be like Todd, you know? I could play like some of these instruments. I could do this if I had a studio. And I thought for a couple of years that I want to get good enough so I can audition to be in Todd's band. And that's really what I thought I wanted to do. I wanted to be in Todd's band. His band was called Utopia.
Yeah.
And this wasn't just, I think, that lets the kids dream about stuff. I really wanted to do this. You know, I thought this would be something I would do. And ultimately, you know, who knows why everything happens, but it didn't happen. And maybe that's got something to do with why, in later life, I came around to work with Todd. Because if in some way, we were in a band together for about 2 years, you know, and we started... Well, in a metaphorical sense, because Todd and I started Context Labs, which is
right.
What Context Media derived from. Todd and I worked together on Patronet, which was his very first online project. So in some way, I got to work with Todd like we were in a band together. So it's like that's what I mean about the dream you have when you're a kid.